So just before we start the course, I mean the course, the lecture, I think probably more for my state of mind than yours, I wonder if we could just sit just for a minute and do a little conscious breathing. So if you have both feet on the floor and just shuffle your buttocks back to the back of the seat so that your spine can be comfortable and upright. And just close your eyes for a moment and allow your shoulders to drop. And just notice if there's any tension around your eyes, across your forehead, or in your jaw. And then maybe bring your hands onto your abdomen, one hand above the navel, one hand below. And just with your eyes closed, just become aware of your breathing. So you may find that you can feel your breath in your hands. And maybe as you breathe in, you can feel the abdomen expands and pushes the hands away from you. And as you breathe out, the abdomen returns back. So just start to breathe a little bit deeper. See if you can exaggerate the movement in your hands. And next time you inhale, just savor the breath in your lungs. Hold the breath in your lungs just for a moment before you exhale, breathing through the nose. And once again, just holding the breath just for an extra moment at the top of the inhale. And as you exhale, at the end of the exhalation, again, maybe a slight pause, slight rest before the body's ready to breathe in again. So just two or three breaths like this. Just letting the breath be really smooth and easy. And then at the end of your next exhalation, you can just replace your hands back in your lap and just sit quiet, just sit with your eyes closed and just feel the stillness that you've created. And then just gently open your eyes. So I'm always impressed how quickly just 2 minutes of breathing can completely alter your physiological state and your state of your mind. So I'd like to begin by saying, just some of you can't see me at the back, Namaskar. Namaskar is it's an Indian greeting. It's a beautiful greeting. And what it means is the divine consciousness that is in me, that is my essence, salutes the divine consciousness that is in you, that is in your essence, which is the same divine consciousness that has given birth to the universe. So it's a very beautiful acknowledgement of the sacredness of all life. And if you go to Mumbai Airport and you go in through the immigration, you'll see this sign, Namaskar, written above all the counters. So that's how you're greeted to India. I'd like to say thank you to the school for inviting me. I'm very honoured to be asked to come and speak. And I think you're quite bold to have asked me, because there's never been a talk like this at Chisholm before. And you could say, well, what has an abstruse medical science got to do with the course of intensive esoteric education? And that would be a good question. So I hope to show you that actually there's maybe a little bit more connection than one might imagine. Ayurveda is, maybe I'll stand up so you can see me a bit. Ayurveda is essentially a very practical subject. It's to do with the sorts of things that we do every day, like eat, and it's interested when we eat and how much we eat and, how we prepare our food. It's interested in the sort of work we do and how we rest and relax. When we go to bed, how we sleep, the company we keep, the books we read, all these sorts of things are very relevant to Ayurveda. But I was asked to give a talk on the philosophy of Ayurveda. So the talk I'm giving today is slightly different from what I might normally give, but I hope it will be relevant to this particular audience, in view of what you're studying, and I hope you'll find it interesting. The aim of my talk is to give a general introduction to the subject, including something of its historical and philosophical background, which of course determines its approach to health. And the approach to health of Ayurveda is significantly different from that of modern medicine, as you'll see. It's sometimes called the science of the five elements and the three doshas. And I will be saying a bit about this and hopefully showing you something that's unique about Ayurveda, and also introducing you to its logic. I get very excited about the logic of Ayurveda because it seems to me to really show we know we're part of nature, but how are we part of nature, and how do we interact, and or how are we affected by our environment? And Ayurveda has a way of understanding this. And it's able to make connections between things that you wouldn't even know were connected. So, for example, what would you imagine would be the connection between having maybe a bit of a sore back or, clicking joints or something like that, constipation, waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning with insomnia, maybe having a bit of ringing around the ears, and hiccups. Well, at the end of this talk, I will explain to you how Ayurveda could see a connection between all of that. It would be very unlikely that anybody would have all of those symptoms at once, but even two of them could be significant. What is Ayurveda and where does it come from? So Ayurveda is a system of natural medicine. It's the oldest known system of medicine, and its roots are very ancient. It comes from the time of the Vedas, and if you don't know, the Vedas are the original sacred scriptures of India, and they date from not just hundreds of years ago, but thousands of years ago. They're said to date from what is the beginning of this world age. Ayurveda is closely linked to yoga. It's a sort of complementary or sister science to yoga. And it's since its beginning, it's had a continuous history. And it's influenced medicine in the ancient world. For instance, Tibetan medicine is based on Ayurveda. There are a lot of links between Ayurveda and Chinese traditional medicine. And it also came as not just East, but West as well, and influenced Greek medicine, for instance. And now it's coming to the West, really on the coattails of yoga. According to the World Health Organization, Ayurveda treats about 20% of the world's population still. So we say it comes from the Vedas, and I've already mentioned that the Vedas are the original sacred scriptures from India. They're hymns of praise to the divine in the form of various deities, and they are the work of, or they were said to be revealed to the Himalayan rishis. A rishi means a seer or a sage or an enlightened being, somebody who sees things as they are. And they were revealed to the rishis in the form of the Sanskrit language and in the form of mantras. So mantras are sacred sounds. For instance, you've probably all heard of the sound Om, or verses. For example, I don't know if you've heard of the Gayatri mantra. It's a very famous mantra from these Vedas, and they're to be recited or chanted. So there's a close connection between sound and meaning, rather like in the Arabic of the Quran. They're said to manifest the wisdom of the cosmic mind or the divine mind, and to manifest the vibrations of the divine word through which the universe comes into being. So they reflect the energy of life, not just the life force in us, but the cosmic prana. Prana means life or life energy. And so they possess great vitality and healing power. Outwardly, they're concerned with certain sort of sacrifices and rituals, sacrifices to the gods, but they're written in a symbolic language that inwardly is about self-realization and the unity of existence. And this inner knowledge comes out much more explicitly in the Upanishads, which is said to be the essence of the Vedas. They can also be part of an Ayurvedic treatment. It can be part of an Ayurvedic treatment to have, sacred music playing. And I'm just going to give you an example. Just a minute. Sorry. Let's hope this works. So, and it repeats and it goes on and on. And when I was in India recently, this was one of the pieces of music that was played when I was lying having warm oil poured over my forehead. And I must admit that sometimes I did wonder if I was in heaven. Okay. So, where did we get up to? Okay. I think it's this one, isn't it? So over time, the Vedas flowered into six separate schools of Vedic philosophy. And these brought out the logical and the cosmological and the metaphysical or philosophical implications within the Vedas. And for example, the first two schools are schools of logical philosophy, similar to that of Plato in the West. And it's always considered important that the Ayurvedic doctor has strong rational skills that he's able to support the conclusions of his diagnosis and his treatment with the proper logic. The third one, Samkhya, is also very important because it gives the cosmology that is the background to both yoga and Ayurveda. And Samkhya philosophy describes how it is that this pure consciousness beyond form, beyond anything, gradually takes on form and crystallizes into the forms of the world that we see around us. The fourth school is the school of yoga. And by yoga here, I'm not meaning so much yoga as like the classes that I teach in Hoik, which is more for physical, it's for, you know, physical health and well-being and stress, anti-stress and so on. Here I'm talking about yoga as an application of the Vedic wisdom for self-knowledge, for self-realization. So yoga prepares the mind and the body and the breathing, the breath, in order to actually experience the insights of these other schools. That's what it's for. And as one of the schools of classical school of yoga, the most famous text is called the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which you may have heard of, not sure, which should be read alongside the Bhagavad Gita, which you definitely have heard of. Have you read it?
Yes.
Yeah, good. Okay. The fifth school is to do with ritual and offerings and prayers. And the sixth school, I'm sure you've also heard the name Vedanta. That is the philosophy. And Vedanta itself has a number of branches. It all gets quite confusing. So there is Advaita Vedanta, which is non-dualistic. There's Dvaita Vedanta, which is dualistic. And then there's another one, which is somewhere in between the two, qualified non-dualistic. So the Vedanta concerns the nature of God, the soul, and the absolute. And in this first school of Advaita, they say that God and the soul are both manifestations of the absolute, which is its real self. And this school emphasizes the yoga of knowledge, and it emphasizes the highest level of being, Paramatman, which was also mentioned in that Mula mantra we heard, and the absolute. So it starts at the top. The dualistic Vedanta is, it says that God and the soul are distinct and different, but they're eternally related. And it emphasizes devotion of the soul to the grace of God. And the third one is somewhere in between. And the third one is quite interesting in terms of Hatha Yoga, the yoga that we mainly know of, because Krishnamacharya was the teacher of Mr. Iyengar, the teacher of Patabi Joyce, who developed Ashtanga Yoga, the father of Desikachar, who's another very famous yoga teacher. And he was of that line. Whereas some of the earliest people who came to the West last century, like you might have read Autobiography of a Yogi by Yogananda and someone else called Swami Vivekananda, they were of the first school, the Advaita school. So there is a striking variety of beliefs within Vedic philosophy. There are teachings which emphasize the idea of the single creator, the creator of the universe. And they worship him as father, mother, master, friend, beloved. There are other teachings that talk about lots of gods and lots of divinities, and which also recognize a divine face in every stream, every mountain. And that's more like pantheism, what we call pantheism. And then there are yet others like the non-dualistic Vedanta, which you might call monistic, which emphasize one reality, which is beyond God, beyond the soul, beyond the universe. And then there are others that combine all of these. So I really think that you would have had to have studied Ibn Arabi not to be confused by this. because that's the only thing that, you know, this is the amazing thing about the study that you do here, that it enables you to, you know, to understand things that seem so contrary and so confusing. But if you thought about it, I'm sure you would be able to make sense of it. Okay. So just a word about a bit more about yoga. As I say, yoga is primarily a spiritual science, and you can see that from its definition. And yoga comes from the Sanskrit yuj, which means a yoke. So it's a bit like religio, you know, tying together. And it actually means union. So yoga is the state of oneness with the divine as one's inner being. It's also, as well as being a state of being, it's also a means of arriving at that state of being. And some of the tools like asana, pranayama, mantra, meditation, they are tools that help in this end. As I said, Ayurveda and yoga go together. They both come from the same source. They were both taught by lines of Vedic sages. And together, as it were, they make a complete science. So whereas yoga is the application of Vedic knowledge for self-realization, Ayurveda is the Vedic system of health and well-being. And Ayurveda is considered to be the best foundation for yoga, and yoga is considered to be the fruit of Ayurveda, because ultimately, the ultimate healing is self-knowledge, knowing who you are. That's what really makes you whole. So, we've talked about different schools of Vedic knowledge. Yoga also has different paths. And again, I'm not talking about Iyengar yoga, Ashtanga yoga, you know, those are different styles of asana. I'm talking about things like Jnana yoga, which is the yoga of knowledge. So if you're a Jnana yogi, you might study Vedanta and you might meditate on questions like, who am I? You might go deeply, deeply into questions like, who am I? Bhakti yoga is the yoga of love and devotion. Karma yoga is the yoga of selfless service. And if you've been reading the Bhagavad Gita, these two are very, very much stressed. Then there's Raja yoga. Raja means royal yoga. And this is particularly relating to the book I mentioned before, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. And this emphasizes meditation and the mind. So the first or the second sutra in this text, it says, yogaha chitta vritti nirodaha. And what that means is yoga is the stilling of the fluctuations of the mind. And by the fluctuations of the mind, it means the thoughts, but it even means the subconscious, you know, disturbances. And then there's Hatha yoga, which is a combination of asana, pranayama, mantra, meditation. So just looking at particularly the first four, knowledge, love and devotion, selfless service, meditation, I just wondered if that reminded you of anything. So here you are, you see. Here you have the Bhishara school described as a school of yoga. So, I mean, what you see in this diversity that I've shown you is how Indian culture is very, very tolerant of different approaches to spirituality, which reflect the different inclinations and strengths of people. And it's always honored individual spiritual experience over and above, you know, adherence to dogma or outer authority or outer institutions. And actually yoga, because yoga actually can fit with anything, because it's more practices. And so yoga itself offers a path, maybe even for people who have no particular religion or who don't even believe in God, because it's to do with direct knowledge of experience. Okay, so now we're on to the history. So this is where the Vedas came from, all these thousands of years ago. This is the region of the Indus civilization, and these cities, it had these great cities that were on the Sarasvati River. So it covers an area that today would be most of Pakistan, northwest India, southeast Afghanistan, and eastern parts of Iran. And what happened was that eventually, in about 190 BC, the river dried up. And so the civilization moved east towards the Ganges. Now, we've mentioned that over time, the Vedas developed into these six schools. And at the same time, Ayurveda, which is said to be a sub-Veda, developed as a distinct subject of its own. And the first practitioner of Ayurveda is said to be Dhanvantari, it's said that he is the original sage of Ayurveda, and it's through his guidance and grace that the subject is learnt. So if you go to an Ayurvedic clinic or somewhere, you'll often see a picture of Dhanvantari. You might also see a statue of Ganesh, the elephant god. He's also very much associated, and he's supposed to be the one who overcomes obstacles. He gives wisdom and he overcomes obstacles. And Dhanvantari is said to be an incarnation of Vishnu, who guides and protects the universe. So, originally, Ayurveda was an oral tradition, but gradually over time it came to be written down. And these are the three main classical texts of Ayurveda. You notice the word Samhita in the first two. A Samhita is a compilation. So these weren't necessarily, written by these people, Charaka and Sushruta, in the sense of being their original work. What they did was bring together the knowledge that was already there in oral form. The Charaka Samhita was a school of internal medicine, and it set out Ayurvedic anatomy and physiology. It set out the doshas, Vata, Pitta, Kapha. It set out the principles of digestion and metabolism and immunity. And it was the standard text for 2,000 years. It was translated into Latin, it was translated into Arabic. Sushruta is the surgical school and deals more with Pitta and the blood. And these two texts, they were written in sutras, in poetic form, so that you could remember them. The third main text comes quite a lot later, and it is more in prose, but I think it's easier to follow. Now, the interesting thing about these ancient texts is that they're still studied today. And I have here, for example, a massage oil that I make called Vatchamaka oil, and the recipe for this comes from the Charaka Samhita. And when I went and studied in India with Dr. Joshi, this is what he taught us. He taught us the Charaka Samhita. So what's interesting is that the principles of Ayurveda haven't changed. All the details, all the knowledge of plants and their effect on the body and everything, all of that knowledge is constantly building. But the fundamental principles don't change. So it's different from science, which has one paradigm and then can suddenly have a totally different paradigm. So just a little bit more about the history. By the time of the Buddha in about 500 BC, Ayurveda was already a well-established medical science with a long, long tradition. And over the next centuries, it spread through India as part of its classical culture. And it was taken up by different religions, by Buddhism, by the Jain religion, and as we were saying, it reached as far east as Indonesia, Indochina, China, and as far west as Greece. And that the medicine of Hippocrates, which talked about the four humours, is based on the same sort of philosophy of Ayurveda. However, in the medieval period, I think, I don't know my dates, but maybe after about 1000, the Muslim invaders came from Central Asia and conquered India. And they closed down some of the colleges and some of the libraries, and Ayurveda went into a period of decline. But that wasn't anything like as bad as when we went there. And the British absolutely banned Ayurveda. They threw the vaidyas, the doctors, into prison. They even cut off their right hand so that they couldn't take the pulse. And it existed, it continued underground, but it was that's what happened. And then into the modern period with independence, it's starting to have a little bit of a revival. So Ayurveda is now taught in India alongside modern medicine, but it doesn't have the same prestige. And most doctors, most young doctors, they choose to do modern medicine because it has more prestige and you earn more money. And just a nice, interesting story. The doctor that I work with, Dr. Joshi, 30 years ago, he was a young doctor. He was just qualifying, and he wanted to be a surgeon. But his mother became ill. She'd had this parasite, she'd had parasites, which is common in India, and they had actually gone into her liver and were causing cysts, and this was a very bad situation. So she was taken into hospital. She had the best care because they had medical links. And these doctors said, this is amoebic hepatitis. I'm afraid we don't know how to treat it. And they gave her these drugs and had horrible side effects, and it looked as though her life was in danger. So she said, I can't bear this, I want to go home. I want to be at home. If I'm going to die, I want to die at home. And she went home, and as a sort of last resort, they did know about Ayurveda, and they thought, well, we'll ask an Ayurvedic doctor. He came along, he gave her a thorough examination, he prescribed her a very strict diet and gave her some herbs, and within 3 weeks she was better. And that had, as you can imagine, that had a huge impact on this young medical doctor. And he decided then he was going to specialize in Ayurveda. He wasn't going to become a surgeon. And he's devoted the last, 30 years as a physician of Panchakarma, which is the strongest treatment of Ayurveda. Okay. So what does Ayurveda actually mean? Well, Ayur is from Ayus, which means life. Ayo means long life, longevity, and Veda means science or knowledge. So Ayurveda is, you could say, the science of life. So when we say science, it is a science in the modern sense, in that it is a progressive knowledge that's built up through, repeated observation of nature and experimentation. And that's how, over years and years, centuries and centuries, a lot of this knowledge has built up. It's also based not just on observation of nature, but on self-observation. And if you want to apply Ayurveda, you have to learn how to observe yourself accurately. There are different types of knowledge, and the highest form of knowledge is always considered to be not knowledge that you get from books, not knowledge that you get from someone else who knows it, but knowledge that you have incorporated into yourself, that you know from your own experience, knowledge that's firsthand. And again, going back to what we were saying about its origin, from the rishis, who are these seers who see things as they are, they just saw things directly. So from this, one understands that Ayurveda is actually an innate knowledge. It's not something, it is actually something that we have naturally a grasp of. Okay, so Ayur, the definition then of life. Life, according to Charaka, is described like this. It's described as the intelligent coordination of four aspects: the soul, the mind, the senses, and the physical body. And the physical body comes last. So, health, according to Ayurveda, is not just about the body, It's not just about what's wrong with us and our ailments and the medicines that we take. It's about the whole human being. And Ayurveda gives as much importance to the subjective, non-physical aspects of our being, you know, our mind, our consciousness, as it does to the things that can be perceived by the senses, the physical aspects. In fact, it says that the non-physical aspects animate and direct the physical and are actually more important. In fact, most disease, apart from things like an accident or I don't know, some in hereditary disease, but most chronic illnesses, it said, they begin in the mind. So, according to this view, you can't really understand the physical body until you understand the senses which nourish and protect the body. And you can't really understand the senses unless you understand the mind, which tells the body what it's going to do, and the senses what they're going to do. But you can't understand the mind unless you can understand the innate intelligence, which is where the mind comes from. And that is sometimes called the soul, the jiva atman. And the soul is what gives us our sense of I. And it's said to be, if we can listen to that inner I, then it will guide us to what's good for us and for what we're here for, you know, what we're supposed to be doing with our lives. The soul is also sometimes called the self, the Purusha. But by the self, it's not what we normally mean by the self, you know, my body, my mind, my memories, my reactions, my feelings. It's not the self of the mind, it's more the self of the witness of the mind. So it's that which was never born, will never die, can never get ill, never changes. And according to this tradition, the true self is actually the universal or the cosmic being, the divine consciousness that I spoke of at the beginning with the greeting of Namaskar, that pervades everything but is beyond everything. And so the Jiva Atman, as the individuated soul, relates to the cosmic self a bit like that lovely analogy of the wave and the ocean. So just when a wave rises up in the ocean rises up into a wave, it doesn't stop being the ocean. And in the same way, if the self individuates as one of us, our status as a universal self is not compromised. Okay, so you might think then, well, if I have this soul, you know, this inner being which knows what's good for me and which guides me, why is it that I end up, you know, doing things that I know aren't good for me? And the answer is the mind. And Ayurveda has, there is a whole philosophy of the mind, or rather a whole psychology of the mind, which comes from yoga, but that's another lecture. You're spared that one. Okay, so just to summarize, it's a science that encompasses the different levels of the human being in a sort of vertical dimension, but also relates the interior to the exterior in a sort of horizontal dimension, and which aims to create life that is in harmony, so that we're in harmony both with all the levels of our being and also with the outside nature. And here's, I don't know if you saw these, I think these were in Richard Twinch's lecture last year. Do you know what that is? Neurons, well done. Structure of the brain, neurons and synapses 2 millimeters across. You know what that is? Well, it could have been, but it's also the structure of the universe at 1 billion light years across. So that's a lovely sort of visual image of, you know, the microcosm and the macrocosm, the human being and the universe. Okay, so what is the aim of Ayurveda? So the aim of this health science is to give you the best, as Avi mentioned, positive health, the optimal health, in order to achieve the four goals of life. And in Indian thought, they see the four goals of life. First of all, kama, which is the word from the Kama Sutras, and it means pleasure. So it's to do with life's legitimate pleasures. So everything, all the beautiful things to see and to hear and to touch and to smell and to feel, all the wonderful things about this world, not overindulging in them, but enjoying them, appreciating them. That's what we're here to do. Artava is sometimes translated as wealth, and it really means being able to fulfill your basic needs of, shelter, food, looking after your family, giving them education, the basic things, which if you don't have, you can't really, it's very hard to think about other things. Then there's your dharma. This has different meanings, but in this context, it's like what you're here for, your life's purpose. And it could, there's no moral judgment attached to it. It could be to be a politician. It could be to be an artist. It could be to drive a digger in a marble quarry in Kilkenny. It could be. But the thing is that if you don't find it, if you don't fulfill your dharma, you will feel in your life that there's something missing. There's just something missing. And then the fourth one is moksha, which means liberation or enlightenment. And traditionally, in Indian society, this happened when you got a bit older, when you'd fulfilled all your responsibilities, when you had fulfilled the other three goals, then you didn't look outside, but you started to look inside. You started to look inside for, the things that make you happy that aren't transient, that are eternal. So I think in our society, we recognize the goal of, pleasure. We recognize, responsibility of looking after our family. We recognize, the idea of our profession, our vocation. But on the whole, I don't know if we have quite the same view of moksha, because I think we're so goal-oriented and we rush about so much. We think that unless you're busy making money and, rushing around, well, then you're not really being very successful. And we don't have the same idea of that it's all right just to be, that there's doing, but there's also being, and that is something worth striving for. So the Ayurvedic approach then, it's not just to cure you when you get ill, but even better than that, it's to stop you getting ill in the first place. And one way that it's very helpful in this regard is that it has a narrative of the disease process, which has six stages. And it's not until you get to stage five that you have something that you could call a disease, like arthritis or diabetes or whatever, something that the doctor would acknowledge and recognize. There are these four stages before that where there are symptoms, but if you go to the doctor, he'll do all these tests, he'll say there's nothing wrong with you, you're fine. Ayurveda has a way of identifying those symptoms and treating them. And it's not just symptomatic, it doesn't just want to, get rid of the symptoms, it wants to find the cause, and how that happens, we'll explain in a minute. So, Ayurveda is a very sophisticated science. It's not just a one size fits all. And modern medicine is coming to the stage of understanding, the DNA, individual DNA. And there is this possibility that there might be tailor-made medicine in the future, that's linked to your specific DNA coding. But Ayurveda has always treated the individual person. Hang on, sorry. For instance, if there are two people who have the same symptoms, they won't They're unlikely in Ayurveda to get exactly the same treatment. And that's because it's not just the symptom. There may be a number of herbs or things that you can do for this treatment, but why you choose this one as opposed to that one depends on what you can see of this person's unique constitution, their nature. Also, things like their age, things like their strength. These would all be factors that would be taken into account. So, as I say, it can do this because it has a way, it has a logic that enables it to actually determine what your unique nature is. So once you, this is something you have to really, you're the best person to know this. And you find out about it, one, by learning a little bit about Ayurveda. Unfortunately, it's not like you have to become a doctor. It's not that sort of study. There's quite a lot, but there's not that much that you need to know in order to begin this process of self-observation that should start, that you should start being able to link, understand things. And once you've done that, that knowledge gives you, it informs you of the sorts of things that are going to be good for you and the sorts of things that are not going to be so good for you. But the challenge is that then you have to take responsibility. So you can't blame your doctor. And, that's hard. And in my experience, for me, because I've never been somebody who could rule myself with an iron will, it's something that happens gradually. And it happens, as I experience the benefits, gradually, I'm gradually learning, starting to learn what's good for me, I feel. Welcome, Hamid.
Thank you.
That's okay. So the methods of Ayurveda then. There are three main methods: nutrition, lifestyle, and herbs. The first two are 60% of the matter. The third, what you might call the medicines, is only 30%. And this is why you couldn't just take a herbal treatment and compare it against a drug, because the treatment isn't just herbs. And actually, if you don't do the other bits, you can't expect the herbs to work properly. So I've talked about lifestyle. It's basically everything you do, everything you think, everything you take in, everything, your whole life, especially the things that you do regularly, your habits. But also nutrition is very, very important in Ayurveda. And by nutrition, nutrition isn't just described in terms of fats, proteins, and carbohydrates. You could have two meals that are perfectly balanced in terms of these things, and one they would have a different effect on. Sorry, you could have one meal that's perfectly balanced, and it would have a different effect on two different people because people are different. So the way Ayurveda thinks about nutrition, food is considered in relationship to the metabolism of the eater. So it's not just that you are what you eat. More important, more precise, you are what you can digest. And what you can digest is the food that becomes absorbed, and it either becomes energy for you to live and be enthusiastic, or it becomes tissue, new tissue, parts of your body, that are good. And if you don't absorb it, the tendency is that not all of it gets eliminated and some of it stays in the body and it becomes, toxins, and this is the beginning of the disease process. Okay, so I said that Ayurveda has a way of identifying your unique constitution. So now I'm going to talk about that, and now we're getting on to the subject of the five elements. So this is going back to the Samkhya philosophy, which is the cosmology of Ayurveda. I'm going to cut a very long story short, and I'm going to say that pure consciousness, in taking on form, goes through lots of phases and stages of levels of mind and subtle matter and so on, until when it comes into being in this world, it's through something called the five great elements, Pancha Mahabhuta. Pancha means five, Maha means great, and Bhuta means element. And the theory of the Pancha Mahabhuta is Ayurveda's conceptual model, and it results in looking at the body. The human body is an absolutely wonderful wonder of nature and what it can support. And there are different ways that you can look at it. So you can look at it in terms of, you know, looking in more and more detail into what it's made up of. You know, so you can have an organ and you see that that's got cells and that's got molecules and DNA and that's made up of atoms, and then there are subatomic particles and all these amazing things we can see through our technology. Ayurveda, you know, acknowledges that, but it's actually more interested in the underlying principles that organize and that govern how nature functions. So it's not so much, it's more of a functional medicine. It's not so much what things are made of, it's how they work. And initially, they work at the level of something that isn't physical. These are what I call organizing principles. You could call them intelligences. You could call them, you know, aspects of consciousness that becomes life, you know, which is always intelligent. And they're a bit like, you know, the laws of a country. If you go to a country, you can't see the laws. Doesn't mean they're not there. But maybe you can see them by how people behave in the society. And it's similar in this case. And what the Ayurvedic scientists did was that they really, really looked at nature. They were constantly looking at how nature works and then comparing it to the human body. And, you know, understanding how are we part of nature. So these principles are what inform what then becomes matter. And in Ayurveda, matter is described as the five elements. And normally we think of four elements, earth, water, fire and air. Ayurveda adds a fifth, which is space. And these elements, they are the building blocks of nature. And they don't just manifest all at once. They have a particular sequential order that they come into being, which is from the most subtle space into the most obvious, the most material, which is earth. So I'm now going to give you an example of how the Ayurvedic scientists learnt about these Panchamahabhuta by observing nature. And we're going to take the example of a seed. So if you have a little seed and you put it between your fingers and you press it, it's quite hard, you can't squeeze it, it's quite compact and dense. But as soon as that seed starts to sprout, you'll find that it starts to create space inside itself. So that if you were to press it, you could actually, you know, you could press. It wouldn't be so resistant. And that's the first stage. That's the indication of space, the first of the elements. And when it expands all the way around. It's you know, in every direction. It just makes space in every direction. Gradually, this movement of expansion starts to move in just one direction. So inside the seed, there's a sprout begins to form. And this is said to be the indication of vayu. Vayu, we've translated as air, but actually, it's not very helpful to think of it like that. It's more moving air, it's wind. If you think of vayu more as wind, because its quality is movement. So this is the beginning of movement that goes in a particular direction. In order to break out of its case, I've lost one of my things, never mind. In order to break out of its casing, there then has to be a metabolic change. And what this is, it's the seed, the pH of the seed changes from acid to alkaline, and that brings about an increase in temperature. So here we have the manifestation of Agni, which means fire. It's to do with chemical changes, metabolic changes. And then gradually, as the plant grows, it has to carry nutrients up to the pots that are growing, and they're carried through the sap. So this is the evidence of water, which is called jala, and it's to do with how things grow, how they increase unit by unit. And then finally, the plant starts to acquire shape and structure. These minerals are taken to the, to form, the plant consolidates into a particular leaf shape, branch shape, form of the tree. And that is evidence of the earth element or prithvi. And I won't do it now, but you could look at the development of a fetus in the womb, and you could identify these stages as well. So by the time you have form, you can be sure that the other four elements are all already there working together. So just very quickly to say that the quality of space is non-resistance. We think of space as a great expanse of empty nothingness, but it does allow, it provides the matrix for things to exist. Things exist in relation to one another in space. The other interesting thing about these elements is that each one of them corresponds to one of the senses. Now, why I think this is so interesting is to do with the Vedic understanding of the purpose of creation. And one answer as to, why did pure consciousness manifest? One answer might be, well, for no reason. There wasn't a reason. It wasn't for anything. It was sort of gratuitous. But another reason that's given is that it was in order to be perceived, in order to be seen. And so, in that sense, it's not surprising that, the primal forms of matter, which is what can be seen, are linked to one of the senses, which is what perceives. So the corresponding sense to space is sound. The air or the wind, as we said, movement is its function. Do you remember Ayurveda is a functional science? So the Vayu governs the flow of blood in our veins. It governs the lightning movement of the nerves and the neurons and the messages in the nervous system. It governs the movement, everything from the tiniest atom to the biggest galaxy. And also it has the quality, wind tends to dry things out. It tends to start to disintegrate things, to, break down cohesion and, separate and disintegrate. It corresponds to the sense of touch. I'm just going to do these really quickly. Fire. The function of fire is conversion and transformation. So the main source of fire in the world is the sun, and the sun brings about photosynthesis in plants, which makes food, which then we eat. And then we also, in the area of our solar plexus, the sun, the fire, we have what in Ayurveda is called the digestive fire, which is actually things like enzymes and digestive acids, which transform an apple into me. That's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? But that's what they do. And the fire, it corresponds to sight, and the organ is the eye. So you can see in somebody's eye, you can see the light of the eye, and if somebody's enthusiastic, you can see, that there's a light in their eyes. It's not like when you go and buy a fish, you look at the eye, make sure it doesn't look too dead, if it has a little bit of light to it, there's still a little bit of life there. Water is to do with liquidity, cohesion, and growth. It protects and lubricates. So we have water on our eyes to protect our eyes. We have saliva to protect the tongue. We have synovial fluid in our joints to stop them rubbing against one another. We have mucous membranes that stop the acids burning holes in our gut. All these sorts of things. They're example. And when we say water, we're talking metaphorically. We're talking about the liquid state. I should have said that. That these elements are metaphors. They're to do with space. Air is the gaseous state. Fire is the radiant state. Water is the liquid state. And earth is the solid state. And water corresponds to taste. And again, this is an absolutely huge subject in Ayurveda, which I can't go into. And then finally, we have the earth, which gives solidity, structure, and which is linked to the sense of smell. So we're just coming towards the end.
Are the doshas the qualities?
Well, I'm just about to get onto the doshas now. So the Panchamahabhuta, the five great elements, they provide the framework for understanding how nature works. But they also provide the framework for understanding how the body works, because these elements also exist in the human body. But in the human body, five become three, and they become the three doshas, which are Vata, Pitta, and Kapha. So the doshas are the five elements in the human body. They each join together two elements. So the first one, Vata, is space and air. And at the very beginning, when we sat and breathed, I don't think I did say this, what I meant to say, I meant to ask you to notice how the body expands to receive the air and how it contracts to get rid of the air. And, you know, is it that the air causes the expansion, or is it the body expands to receive the air? I mean, they're so beautifully married together that you can't tell. Well, these are the two elements. You can see how space and moving air go together. Then there's Pitta, which is fire and water. Then there's Kapha, which is water and earth. And these doshas, we all have them. We all have all three of them, but we have them in different proportions. And it is the interrelation of the doshas that determines our individual constitution. So that's This is the logic, and it's done through these elements. And our individual constitution determines not just our body, all sorts of things about our body, but it also determines what we think of as our personality. You can see as coming from these doshas. So the doshas, again, they're hard to grasp. You can't see them under the microscope. They have to be inferred and deduced from other things that you can see. And in order to start to observe the doshas, you have to learn their language. And the language of the doshas is their qualities, their qualities. So there are these 10 pairs of contrasting qualities. Which describe the different elements, and they combine to form the three doshas. So, for example, you see here that each dosha has some qualities that belong to it alone. Vata is the only one that's dry; the other two are oily or wet. Pitta is the only one that's hot; the other two are cold. And Kapha is the only one that's heavy; the other two are light. And then there are these other qualities, you know, that sort of derive from them. So the way in which the Ayurvedic physician makes his diagnosis and makes his treatment is on the basis of observing these qualities. And on the rule is like increases like and opposites reduce. So, for example, I've got here some oil, some massage oil. So, let's just go back to have a look at those qualities. What quality might the oil have?
Smooth.
It's smooth. It's very smooth. It's not rough. It's flowing, yeah, it's not solid.
It's clear.
Yes, it is actually clear. It's wet. It's wet. I mean, another thing we could say there is oily. You know, it's wet in a particular way, not just wet like water, it's oily. So, which dosha do you think this would be specially good for? That's right, the dry, hard and rough dosha. So this is just to give you an example of how it works. So one of the main treatments for Vata dosha is not necessarily, you know, great details of this food or that food. Oil massage is very, very good for Vata dosha. And especially if I warm it up, because Vata is cold, I want to have it nice and warm. And if I then, you know, have this lovely sort of gentle movement with this lovely unctuous, that's a nice word I learned through Ayurveda, unctuous, this lovely unctuous substance, it will really calm down Vata dosha if it gets high and aggravated. Now, I haven't got time to explain how these qualities appear in the body or in the personality, but just to finish off, I'll go back to do you remember I asked at the beginning, what's the connection
between hiccups?
Have you got both of those? Okay, what did I say? I said, where was it? Oh, you've got them all. Good, okay. Okay, well, does anyone know what the answer is?
Vata.
The answer is Vata dosha, and let me just explain why. So we start off with the bones. The bones they're very porous. They have lots of space in them. You know, they're not solid structures. There's a lot of space in the bones. And they are actually the one tissue of the body that kapha governs. Most of the body is governed by, that. Sorry, that Vata governs. Most of the body is governed by kapha. So if you have problems with your bones, well, it may be caused by Vata, but at least or not, but it's certainly a Vata organ, so that's something you have to consider. Secondly, we had constipation. One of the very interesting things about the doshas is that whilst they exist all over the body and have certain sites, they all have a main residence in the body, and their main residence is in the digestive tract. So one of them lives in the stomach, one lives in the small intestine, and one lives in the colon. Vata lives in the colon. Vata is very dry. A dry colon gives you constipation. What was the next one? Insomnia. Well, waking up at 4 in the morning, the dosha is also linked to various cycles of time. 4 in the morning is the middle of Vata period of night. And if you're suffering from insomnia, it means there's too much light quality in your head. You know, you need heavy sleep. You need something to, you know, it's heavy. Sleep is heavy in order to be able to go to sleep. Your brains may be too active. You know, you're too up here. You need to come down here. What was the other one?
Ringing of the ear.
Sorry?
Was it not a ringing of
the ear? Oh, yes, ears. Well, I don't know if you remember, but the sense associated with air, with ether, was sound. So again, there's a connection with Vata. And then the last one was hiccups. And this is interesting because I remember some time ago, I saw a program on television about this poor person who had hiccups and he just couldn't stop them. And I don't think they did find a remedy for him. And I was just reading in a book by Dr. Joshi where he has some case studies. And he also said that somebody came to him who had these terrible hiccups. And he couldn't sleep and he couldn't take solid food. It was just awful. And he tried other forms of medicine and, you know, nothing was working. And they were going to do operations. And I think they found he had problem in his upper digestive tract, colitis or something like that. Anyway, they came to Dr. Joshi when he was, this was when he was setting out. And he thought about it and he found out that this person had not, you know, been to the toilet for 6 days. You know, they were highly constipated. And as you know, vata, which is the wind, governs movement. And there are five different movements in the body. There's things coming in, there's things going out, there's things going round towards the center, there's, you know, movement out to the circumference, and there's things going down and out. And there's a form of vata which is to do with things going down and out. And what he worked out was that this most important form of vata, which is to do with things going down and out, it was blocked. I mean, the dosha, as it were, was blocked. And that instead of moving in its proper direction, going down, it was actually moving up. And therefore, it was aggravating this other dosha, the one that actually makes you have hiccups, the one that comes from, you know, the diaphragm up and out through the mouth. It was aggravating that dosha. And so he thought, you know, the doctors had all looked at this problem with his upper digestive tract, and they hadn't thought of this. And so what he did, he gave him these enemas, and he gave him, you know, cleansing enemas and nourishing enemas. And first of all, nothing happened. And then after about a day and a half, a lot of very hard stuff came out and the hiccups stopped. So that's pretty amazing, isn't it? That, you know, constipation and hiccups could be related. Anyway, I'm sorry, I've talked rather a long time. Thank you.